Hello, welcome to everyone watching, listening online. So glad that you can join us today. And to everyone gathered here in this space together, I know it seems like every day now there's a little bit more encouraging news, more brightness on the horizon, and it just feels better and better to be together as a church and to be able to see and talk to and smile at and touch one another. May that continue to be the case. One of my favorite spiritual training exercises when I'm working with small groups is an exercise called Visio Divina, which is Latin for sacred seeing. Visio meaning seeing, divina being divine or sacred. It's sacred seeing, and it's a form of contemplative prayer where we ask for and wait for the Lord to speak to our hearts as we look upon or gaze upon an image or an object. And I use, those of you who've done this exercise with me before, you know I use a variety of paintings and icons to engage us in this exercise. And one of my favorites is an icon painted by a Russian artist named Rublev. This icon is sometimes called the Trinity. Sometimes it's called the Hospitality of Abraham. It is a depiction of the three angels that Abraham entertains in Genesis 16, but really it's a depiction of the relationship between the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. It captures the essence of what theologians, both ancient and modern, have called, fancy word alert, perichoresis. Let me hear you say perichoresis. Perichoresis. It literally means the circle dance. Peri meaning around, choresis meaning dance, as in choreography. It's a dance in the round. It's a circle dance, a divine dance in a circle. And if you've never heard of perichoresis before, don't worry, you are not alone. When I was growing up, I heard sermons about the evils of dancing. I did not hear a sermon about the divine dance in a circle, perichoresis. What it is the way the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit exist and move and work together in perfect harmony and unity, in an intimate relationship of mutual self-giving love. And while the word perichoresis never occurs in the New Testament, much of the source material for it is found in the Gospel of John, especially Jesus' farewell address to his disciples in John 14, 15, 16, chapter 17, if you include the prayer. And in this section of the Gospel of John, Jesus spends quite a bit of time talking about his relationship as the Son with the Father and his relationship with the Spirit. Says in chapter 14, verse 10 and 11, notice the interplay between the members of the Trinity in these verses. It says, "Don't you believe that I'm in the Father and that the Father is in me? In the words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say I'm in the Father and the Father's in me," or at least believe in the evidence of the work themselves. And then at the beginning of his prayer in chapter 17, he says to his Father, "Father, the hour's come," talking about his crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension that's about to happen. "Glorify your Son so that your Son may glorify you." This mutual glorification. So the Father sends the Son into the world with a specific purpose and mission. And the Son represents the will of the Father by speaking the words of the Father, by obeying the commandments of the Father. And then we saw last week the Father and the Son send the Spirit into the world with a specific purpose and mission. In chapter 16, verse 4, Jesus says that the Spirit of truth, the Paraclete, will glorify me because it is from me that the Spirit will receive what he will make known to you. So now it's the Spirit glorifying the Son, who glorifies the Father, as the Father glorifies the Son. And it's this eternal circular dance where God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit manifest and put on display the goodness and the glory and the self-giving love of God. And it goes round and round and round. In John 15, Jesus uses agriculture, farming, or more specifically viticulture, vine tending, rather than choreography, thank goodness for that, to convey a similar message. This is what he says, chapter 15, beginning in verse 1. He says, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. And you are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain or abide," different translations render that differently, "remain or abide in me as I also remain, abide in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must abide in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you abide in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. And if you do not abide in me, you are like a branch that's thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. But if you abide in me and my words abide in you, then ask whatever you wish and it will be given or done for you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples." You don't have to own a vineyard to make sense of this allegory. Jesus is the true vine. Disciples are the branches. The Father is the gardener who lovingly cares for the vine by cutting off or pruning the branches to maximize the production of fruit. That's all fairly straightforward. Embedded in this allegory, though, is a command, an imperative from Jesus. As he's doing his job as the vine, as the Father is doing his part as the gardener, Jesus says to his disciples, says to us, "I command you," it's imperative, "you must abide in me, the vine, as I abide in you." And that word abide, it's one of John's favorites. Pointed this out before in our journey through the Gospel of John. It shows up over and over and over again. Remember at the beginning of the Gospel in chapter 1, two would-be disciples are walking behind Jesus and they ask him, "Where are you staying? Where do you abide?" And Jesus says, "Come and see." And they follow Jesus and they see that he abides in the Father. And then last week we saw at the beginning of chapter 14, Jesus tells his disciples, preparing them for his departure. That's why it's called a farewell address. Preparing them for his departure, he says, "I am going away to prepare a dwelling or abiding place for you in my Father's house." And then later on in chapter 14, verse 23, Jesus says, "Anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home or abiding place with them." So Jesus' mission, his purpose, his work, it seems is not so much to go prepare a place somewhere else up in the sky for us to abide with God as it is for him to make us the place where he and his Father and the Holy Spirit abide. And the purpose of all of this abiding, we abide in Jesus, Jesus abides in us. The purpose of this, he says, is so that we can produce abundant fruit that glorifies God and proves our connection to the vine as Jesus' disciples. We are known and judged by our fruit. Fruit don't lie. In the fall, we studied the fruit of the Spirit from Galatians 5. There are tangible, observable fruit that manifests themselves in our lives as we abide in Jesus and Jesus abides in us and as the Holy Spirit works in and through us. Fruit don't lie. It's our fruit that proves that we are following Jesus. And you notice in this passage, he never commands us to produce fruit. That's not the command. He never puts us on a quota to say, I need to see this much fruit out of you every day, every week, every season. We don't produce the fruit in and of ourselves. We have no power within us to produce fruit. The fruit comes from the power that's in the vine. And so Jesus commands us to stay connected to the vine, abide in the vine. He also doesn't command us to go around cutting or pruning the other branches. As tempting as it is to judge and cut and prune and adjust and pick at those branches that appear to be unproductive, Jesus says, that's not your job. You are not the gardener. God is. Your job, your task, your focus is to abide. We must abide in him. And if this notion of mutual abiding, abiding in Jesus as Jesus abides in us, if that still seems a bit abstract, just keep reading, because as he goes on, he clarifies and makes concrete what this mutual abiding looks like in the everyday practice of a disciple. He says, continuing in verse 9, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Now abide in my love. Okay, what does that look like? Well, if you keep my commands, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and abide in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this. Ding, 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 ding. This is it. My command is this. If you want to abide in me, he says, you have to obey this command. My command is this. Love each other as I've loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. And you are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends, for everything that I've learned from my Father, I have made known or passed on to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. And so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command. Love each other. How do we abide in Jesus the vine? He says, you abide in me by abiding in my love, which is an extension of the Father's love in which I abide. And we abide in Jesus' love, not by doing nothing or taking it easy dude style. Some of you know what that's from. We abide in Jesus' love by obeying his commandments. And he then boils those down to one big one, one chief command. He says, you love one another. Back in chapter 13, Jesus called this the new command. A new command I give you, he says, but there's hardly anything new about the command from God to love one another, to love your neighbor. What's new about this command is the standard or the motivation behind it. We love one another. The standard and the motivation behind that love is not ourselves. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. No, Jesus ups the ante. You love your neighbor, you love one another as I have loved you. The new standard, the new motivation for loving one another is the love of Jesus for us, which he exemplifies by, he says, laying down his life for his friends, which he exemplifies when he takes off his robe and lays it aside and wraps a towel around his waist and washes the dirty feet of his friends, which he exemplifies when he gives up and pours out his life on the cross. So when we dwell in this passage, in this image that Jesus gives us of the vine, we see all of these concepts, abide, love, obey, fruit, they interlock and support, and well, they dance with each other. Just as the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit interlock and support and dance with one another. We abide in Jesus by abiding in his love, and we abide in Jesus' love by keeping his command to love one another. And we learn to love one another from Jesus, in whose self-giving love we abide. And when we love one another as Jesus has loved us, we produce fruit that glorifies God and proves that we really are abiding in Jesus. And if all of this is starting to sound a bit circular, congratulations, you get extra points for paying attention. To be a God-glorifying, fruit-producing disciple of Christ is to abide in the circle of God's abiding love. And it goes round and round and round, and the dance never ends. I told someone last week that I was trying to illustrate the meaning of the word eternal by preaching a never-ending series from the Gospel of John. It just goes on and on and on. But then I quickly followed up that to say, I'll stop when I run out of material in John or when I begin to repeat myself. And today I feel like maybe I'm in danger of repeating myself. Back in March, I covered how Jesus washed his disciples' feet and then said to them, "Now you do for each other what I just did for you. You love and serve one another the way I have loved and served you." And then in April, I emphasized how Jesus, both crucified and raised from the dead, is the good shepherd who willingly lays down his life for his flock, but then says to Peter and the other disciples, "You too must be willing to lay down your lives for others. You lay down your life for each other the way I've laid down my life for you." And now here we are in May, the month of graduation, and once again, I'm saying, we're pointing to Jesus, who's saying, "You must, this is imperative, you must love one another as I've loved you." This goes round and round and round, doesn't it? Reminds me of a story about Juan Carlos Ortiz, who was a pastor of a rather large church in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Years ago, he wrote a classic book called Disciple. You can still find it in some used bookstores. One Sunday, Ortiz was getting ready to preach to his church about loving one another. And just a few minutes before the sermon, he thought to himself, "How many times have I preached to these people about loving one another? How many sermons have they heard from me? Some of these people have been Christians for a long time. How many sermons have they heard about loving one another?" And in every sermon, I essentially say the same thing and nothing ever changes. So when it came time to preach, he stood up before his congregation and he said three words: "Love one another." And he sat down and began to pray. And the congregation sat there in stunned, awkward silence for 5 minutes. What is going on? Is the sermon over? Can we leave? Is there something wrong with our pastor? And then after 5 minutes, he stands up and he looks at the congregation and he says, "Love one another." And he sits down and prays again. And he does it a third time after several minutes. "Love one another." And he sits down and prays. And after several minutes, one of the elders of the congregation stood up and said to everyone, I think I know what the pastor is trying to say to us. I think he wants us to love one another." And then he said, "But how can we love one another if we don't really know each other?" And he began to initiate conversations with the people around him, where he introduced himself and then asked their name and then asked for any needs they have that he might be able to help meet. And others in the congregation began to follow suit, and soon there were all of these conversations happening. Christians getting to know one another and getting to know one another's needs and putting their heads and their hearts and their resources together to take care of each other. And the congregation came together to transform what was turning out to be a very awkward sermon into a powerful display of loving one another. The truth is, loving one another as Christ has loved us is Christianity 101. It's also Christianity 201 and 301 and 401. And if you want to get your graduate degree in Christianity, guess what you study? We never graduate from this subject onto something more important or advanced. It keeps coming back to love one another as Christ has loved you. One of the curiosities of the Trinity icon, if you study it closely, is there's this little square at the bottom center of the table. And some art historians speculate that it is there as residue of glue that was used to, at some point, attach a mirror to the icon, so that whoever looked upon this icon saw in the mirror an image of a fourth participant at the table, of a fourth participant in the circle dance of God. Even if this is not true, and nobody knows for sure if it is, it sure sounds good though, doesn't it? Even if it's not true, I love the idea of this image remind, or the mirror reminding us that we belong in and are participating in the circle dance of God. It captures so well Jesus' invitation to come and see where he abides, but also his imperative to abide in him by loving one another. Last week we saw that one of the big ideas in the farewell discourse is that we as Jesus' disciples can still continue to experience the presence of a physically absent Jesus through the power and presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives, who is within us and walking alongside us. Another big idea of the farewell discourse is that we as Jesus' disciples can continue to experience the presence of a physically absent Jesus by loving one another as Christ has loved us. We are not walking this path alone. We have the Holy Spirit. We also have each other. So let us join in the circle dance of God. And may the love of the divine dance continue to go round and round in us and through us, as we love one another, as Christ has loved us.